Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. This is your trigger warning. This podcast is raw. It is real, and it doesn't sugarcoat what it means to survive trauma, abuse, mental health battles, or even the aftermath of living in survival mode for too damn long. What you hear on Survival Mode Disrupted includes unfiltered stories, graphic details, and a vulnerable truth that may trigger some of the audience. Please prioritize your emotional safety. If something feels too heavy, pause. Breathe. Come back when you're ready or not at all. Your healing is yours to honor. These episodes are based on lived experience, not therapy sessions or clinical advice. Listening does not replace mental health treatment or constitute a coach-client relationship. If you're in crisis, please seek immediate help from a licensed professional or contact your local emergency services. This space is built with care, but it's also built for truth and built for disruption. Take what you need, leave the rest, and most of all, trust yourself. If this podcast speaks to your soul, you don't have to do this work alone. Feel free to join our free Facebook community for high-achieving women ready to break cycles and heal out loud. Join us at Disrupting Survival Mode on Facebook, or grab the book that started this movement, Exiting Survival Mode, a raw step-by-step guide to help you identify, release, and rebuild from the survival patterns that have been keeping you stuck. Hello, 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 and welcome to season two. This is a podcast where we lead with stories to create community, but also to uncover the residual impacts of trauma that we all experience and often don't recognize. I am starting this season with a series of stories from people from my country, Bermuda. And the reason for that is because we've experienced the same issues that we experience worldwide, but particularly in my community, openness about our journeys is not always appreciated. We come from an environment where we are often judged by how we deal with our trauma rather than people taking the time to get to know why we were traumatized in the first place. And I just want to be able to showcase the stories of a few people that have overcome some tremendous things and are now doing amazing things in the world. So welcome to season two. And today we have Mickey. Mickey, why don't you introduce yourself?
Thank you. My name is Mickey Pocket Smith, and I'm here today to tell my story of overcoming trauma, addiction, child sexual abuse, manipulation, betrayal, and what I'm doing differently to just make a change in the world today.
I love that. And I'm super excited to hear your story. But before we get into all of that, how would you describe survival mode?
Survival mode for me, like I say, it would be like always wearing a mask, never really truly being myself, being too afraid to really be open and transparent with the people around me. Jeez, for me, survival mode was numbing myself, not being in a space of reality, always wanted to escape that reality, always wanted to be somebody else. So that's what survival mode really was for me, not acknowledging the things that had going on in pretty much my whole entire life until I had to. Until I felt all the time that I was always just treading with my hair just above the water, and I was always felt like I was right there about to drown if I just, I remember feeling like that for so many years. My hair was just above the water. So yeah, that's what survival mode is was for me.
And I can relate to that as well. I would say that I would describe survival mode as running in place. Putting out a lot of effort and not moving anywhere. So I have been interested in your story behind the scenes since we were in high school. So Mickey and I went to high school together, and there were a lot of rumors about you back then. And even back then, as I journeyed through my own stuff in high school, I was always curious about you. I'm the type of person that kind of wants to know the why behind the why. And it's something that even years later, when we reconnected, I still wanted to know, like, what was your story? So tell us your story to and through Survival Man.
Okay, definitely. To start, the rumors that I'm pretty sure everybody at our school heard. I mean, I used to even hear the whispers. People would approach me and say, "Oh, that's your 30-year, you have a 30-year-old boyfriend," and this and that. And I'm just like, how do you answer that? So yeah, they weren't rumors. They were true, except he wasn't my boyfriend. He was my abuser that kept popping up in all stages of from the time I was 10 years old, right throughout my entire adolescence. I'll start with growing up in a dysfunctional family. And I know everybody has a little dysfunction in the family. I don't think there is no, perfect family. My mom was a really hard worker. She wasn't a nurturer. She was a provider. And now that I took the time out to learn more about myself, I realized that she didn't really have that nurturing when she was coming up. So she was doing the best she could with what she had. My dad was present, but my dad, he drank. He loved to play golf. He played music. His focus was on the women, and I think somehow we all felt that in the household. It was all always arguing and fussing and fighting. And my mom, she was a very she was a very rude and direct. I don't know how to put it, but sometimes she would talk like a drunken sailor. Like, one of the things that was, I guess, pretty dominant in my bringing up was the verbal abuse that came from her. So like I said, she wasn't a natural verbal abuse, putting me down all the time, and that affects a child, especially as you're growing up. And at around 10 years old, so that was me growing up, dysfunctional household, still had my father present when I was growing up. I have siblings that I grew up with, and got to a point in life where gentleman was introduced to my family. Well, not a gentleman, but man was introduced to my family. And at first he was introduced, by someone else in my family. And the connection really started there. This person or my abuser started to see the gaps in my family that wasn't things that weren't getting done around the house. So he would, make himself available in that way, started really gaining our trust, gaining my parents' trust. And through that, he was trusted by my mom to sometimes take care of us. He was really of no fixed abode or had trouble or issues, I should say, with places to stay. So my mom, seeing the fact that he was helping out around the house and that this, would benefit her and she had the space in the house, took him in per se. This was all in a span of maybe 6 months. Not very long at all. I mean, everything happened like that. Wherever this man could help out or see he could help out. And And it, you know, I know now that when it comes to abusers, you know, they always look for that little, that weak link. I'm the middle child. And of course, like I say, my mom was a disciplinarian. My dad was present, but always gone. And so when this man started showing me attention and being able to take me to the movies or take me to the beach, and my mama was actually okay with that because she was working most of the time, then that started to create a bond between us. But at the same time, this man was slowly engaging himself with me in unhealthy ways. It was less than a year before he tried to have his first attempt at sex with me. After a few times, he was successful. So he was actually the first person to ever, you know, that took my virginity. And this basically went on for my entire adolescence, where I was groomed, I was manipulated. I felt as though the adults in my house must have known something because this man was known to the police. Now I know that he actually was committing sexual offenses since the year after I was born, since 1982. So it wasn't just, I had seen the police come to my house, but I had also seen other adults say to my parents, hey, you know, this man's not a good man, you know. I'm not sure how much attention they paid to that, or it's quite obvious, you know, how much attention they paid to it. I can't answer that. Unfortunately, my mom is gone. And as much as we try to get answers, we're left with a lot of unanswered questions. So this abuse, sexual abuse, continued from the age of 10, grooming, manipulation. And when I say manipulation, on the highest of just, it's almost like brainwashing. I don't really know any other way to explain it, but it's just a complete manipulation of everything that they want you to know, how they want you to understand it, how they want you to present yourself. You know, this man controlled every aspect of that. In between the age of 10 and 17, my father moved out of the home. So it was literally my mom, me, this man, and and two other siblings. And so he had a lot of access to us for a lot of years. Some in between the time before I ran away from home, I would say maybe around the age of 14 or 15, this man took me over to another man's house in St. David's. And I still remember the house. I actually went on a drive there when I was doing an internship like a month or so ago. And I haven't been St. David's in years. It's crazy because it's a small island, right? But like, you know, going down St. George's is like a day trip. Like you gotta be, you know. And just having the feeling of driving past that house and everything just like that I don't know how to explain it in your chest, that tightness in your chest just comes back and you're like, wow, my abuser assured me with this man for money. I know I got some of that money. I don't know exactly the exact amount that it was for or anything like that. He allowed this man to perform oral sex with me. And I felt so dirty and disgusting after that. It's a completely different experience than what I was feeling with my abuser than when he took me and used me in that way. That's also around the age I started to become rebellious, wanting to break away, wanting to like boys my own age, having crushes and this and that. And that actually caused some added drama in my life because when I transferred from where we went to school together, and then I had to transfer down to St. George's because that was when they were putting you in your school in your parish. So traditionally, I'm from St. George's, and I remember one night I went over to this boy's house who I really like he was like really my little first boyfriend my age, you know. When my sister found me, she was like, oh, my mama was looking for me, my sister was looking for me. By the time I got him, Daxter was there. That's my abuser's name, John Daxter Seaman III. And instilled so much fear in me about the consequences of my actions and what was going to happen and this and that. And even my mom just was like filling me with so much fear. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. I know that this man is telling me, you better never tell anybody about what's going on with us. And like, I'm just, going over like my first boyfriend's house. And so in my head, I'm like, what do I do? Like, how am I going to protect myself? How am I going to, back then we got licks, like real licks. That was on the board too. And I was scared of my mama. I unfortunately accused three boys of raping me. And even though I can't really explain why, I knew at the end of the day it was to protect myself. To this day is something I feel so much remorse for. I'm actually very good friends with those boys now. I went to their families and I specifically went to them when I was older and sat down and talked with them about like exactly what it was that, was going on in my life and who was I to turn to? Who could I tell? What was going on? That's what I thought of to stop from getting a cut backside, really, from being physically abused. So from then, sorry, I'm just looking at my. So that was about maybe 16 years old, 15, 16 years old when I done that. Because I done that, and because Bermuda is such a small community, especially St. George's, when I went to go back to school, it was hell. I was bullied. I spent 4 hours of the day in the principal's office just to protect myself because I was being targeted. I was being bullied, and rightfully so. I had hurt other people. I ended up dropping out of school. During that time that all of that was going on, I remember being just hiding in the cave down by my house. So I wait for, especially if my mom made work after I was supposed to leave for school, I would put my school clothes on, leave, pretend like I'm leaving for school, go right down the railway trail and hide in this cage till I knew she was going to work. And I'd done that for quite a while because I was just so scared of somebody finding out that I was skipping school because I didn't want to deal with the mess I had created, all in an attempt to make myself feel safe from not being physically abused and being also abused by my abuser. So that was a really difficult time in my life. And even, when they brought that up through my trial, it hit me in my heart because there's some things that you go through things that you mentally put out of your head. That's a protection. That's a protection coping. It's saying that, this has been taken out because mentally you can't handle it. So when I had to face that part of it again, it was very hard for me to do, especially in front of a jury of people that I don't know. So yeah, that was a very difficult time for me. So I dropped out of school 16, started working. By the time 16 started working. Sorry, it's my cat. Around 17 years old, on my 17th birthday, I ran into, or I didn't ran into, run into one of my abusers, abusees, I guess, one of his other victims, approached me. And I knew about her. I knew about a few other ladies. It's like we all kind of knew of each other in some way, shape, or form. So when she approached me, I was like, okay, this is different. This is weird or whatever. And she asked me, she's like, what do you want to do with your life? And my answer was, I just want to do whatever I have to do for Daxter, whatever I can to make him happy. And she was like, seriously? And we sat there talking. And she's like, how long has this been going on? And we talked for a while. And this was on my 17th birthday. And I went home, packed a little outfit. She took me out to my first session that night. And I never went back home after that. So she put herself in a place of trust again for me, someone. And I'm like, okay, even though our conversation brought my thinking wrong to like, this is what this man is doing to you. He's done this to me. We brought up some other names and we're like his, we know we don't we can't prove it, but we know that this is probably going on and this and that here. And so I really started to build a trusting relationship with this girl. I moved into her house. My mom tried to get me to move back home. It was this whole thing with the police. And finally, I went down my mom's house to let her know exactly what Daxter had been doing to me all these years. And she kicked him out. And that was like kind of the end of that situation with anybody addressing in my anybody in my family addressing what I had just said. It really was. It was like, okay, mama, this is what happened. It's been happening under your roof all this time. You was told by other people that, you know what I mean? And that was it. So okay. In between then, or sorry, not in between, after that, I didn't still didn't go back home. And sorry, just trying to think. Sorry. In between then, I still didn't go back home. I was about 16, 17, still working at Grotto Bay was one of my first jobs. McDonald's was my actual first job. I don't know how many people remember McDonald's was on the island, but Grotto Bay was like my first legit job where, I had insurance, and I needed to provide for myself. But I was also starting to experience, I guess, life as a teenager. Between the age of 16 and 17, I got pregnant with my first child. By the time I was 18, I had my first son. And during that time, still hadn't addressed any trauma. It was just like this unspoken thing in my family. Like people knew that this is what had happened to me, but still nobody was acknowledging it. And even me, I was still carrying on like, I guess this is normal, because nobody, I said something, but the only thing happened is he got told to leave. There was no charges pressed or nothing. There was no push for any of that. So yeah, here I am carrying on about life. Had my first son, started work not too long after I had my first son, went back to work. And I done that for a good while as a single mother. When I remember when I found out I was pregnant, sorry, my mom, she was like, I don't have any room for you. So that's when I enrolled in teen services to finish my high school diploma. Because remember, I dropped out of school at 16. And I was about 2 weeks away from taking my final exam when I had my son, which is crazy. I did go back in 2005 and get my GED on my own. And I registered at the Teen Haven for the duration of my pregnancy. And I remember leaving to go to my mama's house right after I had my son, just for 2 weeks, just to see, because I needed that support. I needed that guidance. I'm hoping that now that this baby is her, she will see and change her mind. And that didn't happen. And basically, long story short, I went back to the Haven. I was kicked out because I stayed down my mom's for 2 weeks. And the only shelter I had was shelter at my granny's place, which was a one bedroom, which was full. So I survived on the floor of my granny's living room. That's where we slept, me and my baby. And that was for quite a while. And this went on for maybe about a year or so. My auntie started helping me, with my son, started taking him daycare on some days. My granny was getting, our mobility. She's getting older and stuff like that. And basically, the help was not genuine. One day, I just got a petition for adoption order in the mail from this woman that was helping me, never uttered a word to me about anything, any of this. So by that time, I definitely was feeling it. I think that's probably when I first started experiencing depression, anxiety. Everything was just becoming way too much. Like it was just way too much, the betrayal I felt like I couldn't trust anybody in my family. My siblings have always been a source of strength for me, but at the same time, my mom tried her best to keep me away from her side of the house. So my interactions with my little sister were less than what they was before. You know, like we grew up, we're the closest in age, and my oldest brother and sister, they're closest in age. It's about a good 10 something year gap between these two sets, you know. So, needless to say, it was a while going through these adoption procedures. And whilst that was going on, is when I really started to like venture out. I was experimenting with ecstasy, weed. I was drinking alcohol, but I still wasn't addicted yet. I was go just like, I was like, you know, by that time during the adoption process, my son had been taken out of my care, was literally living with my auntie, started calling her mama. And I'm like, okay. And I remember feeling that one day. And I remember saying to my auntie, I was like, no matter what, like, don't let him call you mama. And I went over there one day because I'm still trying to do all this. I'm still trying to be a young person, deal with, you know, or not even really recognizing that I have to deal with my trauma and all this, and still try to show up and be a mother. And I remember that one time I went over her house and he called her mother. You know, he's like, mama. And that's when I really felt probably one of my lowest. I was like, what is there for me? Really? What is there for me? So through partying, ecstasy, I mean, like I said, I wasn't addicted yet, but I did look forward to Fridays because we would party from like Friday to Sunday, literally. And the whole week was spent. And if anybody knows anything about ecstasy, methamphetamines, you know, you're really high and on this euphoric stage. But once you come down, like you're questioning your existence, you are back to reality. You're like, what the hell is like happening? And that whole process takes about 3 or 4 days. So that was my cycle for quite a while, for a few years. In between there, sorry, I have to look. And so in between the whole ecstasy thing or whatever, I had kind of strayed from the girl that had taken me out of my home in the first place, who had convinced me to leave home. She had some things going on in her life. But whenever we met up, it was just trouble anyway. We got into all sorts of just like shenanigans. Even today, I'm like, yeah, I know it was definitely a toxic bond, but some of the memories that we have is like, wow, you know, that's it's just crazy. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. So, yeah, partying, ecstasy, doing this every weekend. And eventually I was introduced to cocaine. And it's still like it wasn't my thing or whatever. And not too long after that, I got introduced to crack cocaine. And this was after my adoption had for my son had been finalized. This was after like I had left the girl's house, and I'll explain that a little bit later, but I found myself sleeping on somebody's couch, who also liked to party. I think we actually met that way with partying. And then this girl came back into my life while I was down there. And that's really where I had my first taste of crack cocaine. It didn't take long for me to become addicted to that. And, you know, it got really, really bad to the point where I would do anything to get that drug. So between the ecstasy and the crack cocaine, but there's different levels to addiction because I was addicted by then, but I wasn't addicted. You know what I mean? I would still be okay from Friday to Sunday so that I could go party with the ecstasy people. Because I look forward to that interaction as well. And it took a few years. I kind of weaned, or people grow apart or whatever, things, everything comes to an end. That whole scene came to an end for me. And sorry, that whole scene came to an end for me. And that's when the use, more consistent use of the crack cocaine, you know, just kept on getting progressive. So I was sleeping on this man's couch, and he got so caught up that he actually got deported. Couldn't show up for work. He wasn't a Bermuda national, got deported off the island. And then I definitely didn't have anywhere to stay. So That's when I met this guy, and I stayed at my sister's for a little while. I met this guy, and seemed like a cool guy. Long story short, that was a 7-year relationship. That was an abusive relationship. I found out not too long into the beginning of that relationship that he actually abused drugs as well, but he was also a very high functioning alcoholic who got very violent. And, I seen times when he would take my bank card and take all my money. I know one of my biggest memories of that relationship was having to sleep in the car right outside my own apartment. I don't know if you could see it, but this is from him. I remember like one time he was just like verbally abusing me like so much, and I could feel it coming, and I was just like sitting on the couch next to him, and I took a glass and I just smashed it in his face, and I ran like hell. I was like, but he caught me and like hit me in the head with a crutch. I called one of our friends. Both of us had to go to the hospital, but it was ignored. Still, nobody, By that time, all my siblings had moved to England. I was just here with my mom and my dad, and not even with them. I had an estranged relationship with my mom by then. I really didn't see my dad. And if I did, I only went and saw my dad to get money from him. Really, he was convenient for me without having to tell anybody else's story. My daddy is not the man that I thought he was. So, yeah, I turned to him. You got any money for me? You don't? Okay, well, I had become used to using men in that sense because that's what I was groomed to do, right? So, did I feel any way about it? Do I feel any way about it? No. The way that I treated my father, I will still have to say no. He's done far worse than many others in this world. So, when my siblings left, moved to England, I really didn't have anybody then. And I was in this abusive relationship. Oh my gosh. Hid it from my siblings every time they would call. Yeah, everything's fine. But then I started calling my sister and say, hey, would you mind sending me $100? She's like, well, what for? And 2 days later, I'll call again. I say, you know what? That wasn't enough. Would you mind? And this was probably at the very height of me being a functioning, I don't like to use the word addict, but being a high functioning person suffering from the disease of addiction. I had a really good job, always had really good jobs. And my first bonus was like $10,000. My then abusive boyfriend and I had to part ways because I lost my job. He actually lost his job. And I went and got my own apartment. I had just gotten my bonus. And probably in about 6 weeks, not long, that $10,000 was gone. I called my sister at the end of that. I was about to get kicked out of my apartment. I didn't have no food. I didn't have no rent money. So that's when I called my sister and I asked her for help. And I told her what was going on. I was like, listen, I'm on drugs. And she's like, well, what do you mean? I don't think my sister or my brothers had ever been exposed to the stuff that I was dealing with. They really didn't know. By then, I was selling myself. Like I say, whatever I had to do to get those drugs. So when I didn't have the money, that was the next step. When I had reached my limit for the ATM for the day, and I couldn't get no more money out, but I still wanted to get high. What had I been groomed to do my whole adolescence? So she brought me out to England. I was out there for 2 months, came back with a little bit of weight on me. Unfortunately, I came back into a space where I really didn't want to be. My only option at that time was to move with my dad, who had a girlfriend the same age as me. Let's put it that way. Not even a girlfriend, a wife. She was, in fact, I think she was a year younger than me. And just being in that environment, I have to tell you, like, even now I think about it, it just makes me sick to my stomach. I knew I wasn't gonna last there, and I didn't. So when I got off that plane, I went and dropped my bags off, probably close to about 200 pounds I weighed. When I came back in 2 weeks, I was like skin and bones. Even my daddy made a comment to me. And I'm just like, people will just pass judgment on me. Nobody really still acknowledging nothing. And for me to expect my dad to address the things that happened to me was just like, I knew that would never happen. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I got thrown out of that house not too long after and definitely found myself homeless again. And the only way I could find a roof over my head is if I stayed up for nights on end, getting high with people. I slept in caves on North Shore. I seen times when I didn't go sleep for a whole week. I had on the same clothes. I think probably one of my lowest points is when I had to pay rent with my buddy. And even I got tired of that. Yeah, that was some of the lowest points in my life. And when we talk about shame and guilt, like that's still something I hold. I don't care if when I talk about it and I speak it and I verbalize it, like I'm doing something for myself because I understand the reasons now, but it still doesn't change how I'm healing or the fact that I'm still healing because not only did I, and I won't say allow, not only was I manipulated to let somebody abuse me my entire adolescence, but I further created trauma for myself through my addiction. And that's the hard part. I remember somebody threw that in my face. Well, you made the choice. And like it hit me like a, it's like, wow, that's your assessment of me. Yes, I made the choice to numb my feelings and everything that I was going through the use of drugs. So, yeah. I went on like that for a couple years and stayed from couch to couch, place to place. There was times I remember when I didn't get high, maybe for a couple hours. And sometimes I was just stuck. I don't know how to explain it. And I know this is what where my depression, like severe depression came in, but I couldn't move. I was just stuck on a couch or on the floor. And just thinking about everything. And like, I was like paralyzed with thoughts. That also went on for years. Like, I was either getting high, sleeping because I'd been up too long, or reflecting and just being completely paralyzed by my thoughts, by feeling so alone and feeling so worthless and like pointless. So went through that. And then throughout I would say when I became homeless and my friend got deported and all this, I met back up with my fellow abusee that convinced me to leave home and stuff like that. And we was hanging tough by then, because she was also struggling with same things that had happened to me. And she introduced us to a friend of hers. And for once, this person didn't want nothing from us. He was just like, what do you need? And it was a friend of hers from school. What do you need? How can I help you? It was just, we just needed a temporary place to stay till we got on our feet. He didn't know that we was on drugs, like, was a single father doing his thing, hard worker, working most of the time and everything. So yeah, that was like the first solace or place I had to stay where I didn't need to do anything for it. I had a roof over my head. I could get a shower every day. There was always food in the fridge. And this was so foreign to me. Like, can you believe that? Even me questioning all the time, like, yeah, sure, this is okay. Like, always in doubt that at some point something's gonna happen. But it never did. In fact, that person was the first person in the whole entirety of from when I was 10 to now when I was, I'm talking about like 29, I believe, something like that. Started recognizing something was wrong. It's like, you girls go out and you go missing for days. And when you come back, you just want to sleep. And then when you wake up, like, you're so hungry. Like, what is going on? And I listened to my ace girl's response, and I was like, okay, so this is what we're doing. We're covering the truth. We're not really saying what's really going on. And I got kind of tired of going out with her and going on the search. That's basically what addiction is. You're always on the search. And I remember this man approached me one night and he was like, "What's really going on?" And I told him, I was like, "You can't see, like you can't tell what's." And he's like, "No, I really can't. Like I work crazy hours. When I come home, my focus is on my boys and getting sleep so I could go." And I'm like, "Okay, well, we're on drugs." And he's like, "Okay, well, what type of drugs?" I was like, "We're stuck on crack." Like, and he's like, and from then on, the conversation just flowed. He just listened to me, asked questions, never judged me, never asked for nothing in return, was just so interested to know, like, why. The simple fact that he knew my abuser, and this is the kicker, this is where me and my abusee friend parted, was because he was the godfather to her daughter. So that's how they were close from school, friendship, and all that. But my abuser was the father of her firstborn child, who had been taken from her, and making this connection and stuff. And I'm just like, all these things have been hidden from me, right? And I'm like, wow, because that's a different level of trauma bonding. You know, that's when you're, and I'm not passing judgment on her at all, right? She was the one that stepped into my life and let me know that what was happening was wrong. It was disgusting. It was, you know, but she used that opportunity when I was off in addiction, trying to find my way, whatever, to create a stronger bond with her abuser. I can't say use the opportunity, but that's what happened. And coincidentally, he found her way into her family the same way he found his way into mine. So with a struggling family financially, both parents were alcoholics, you know, really just looking for more so financial support and always. I mean, that's exactly the way that happened. And as survivors of him, I can understand in a sense why that decision was made. Because when your family's struggling and you know a way you can fix it, I'm not making excuses for her, but I don't even really know how to feel about that still, tell you the truth. So yeah, me and this guy whose house we was living in, her and I got into this huge fight because I was like, "I don't want to go out with you no more. Like I'm tired." Like she started seeing me and her friend grow closer, and at some point we got closer. And I was starting to feel like this something I had never felt before, like just this acceptance of who I am. The relationship turned intimate. I got pregnant with my second daughter. And I, so remember I said me and this girl used to get up to shenanigans, and every time we got together, it was trouble. Thank you.
Audience, thank you for catching another episode. And I just want to remind you that you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. Once again, thank you for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted, hosted by the Survival Mode Disruptor, Letitia. You didn't land here by accident. This conversation, it probably cracked something open on purpose. Because survival mode isn't just a phase, it's a pattern, an identity, a prison masked as strength. But here's the truth: you're not broken, you're just unfinished. So if something stirred in you today, don't ignore it, don't numb it, move with it. And I want to once again invite you to join Disrupting Survival Mode, the Facebook community where healing is loud and messy and real. I also want to invite you to buy my book, the survival mode exit plan because your breakthrough deserves a blueprint. And if you felt seen today, be sure to share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. Like, subscribe, and drop a review. That's how we amplify the voices that need to be heard. And remember, this isn't about fixing yourself. This is about finding yourself again beneath the rubble. Until next time, choose ease, choose power, choose you. This is Survival Mode Disrupted. Let's keep shaking shit up.